Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. April 22nd, 2018, episode 131, Potential. I'm Kevin England, and this is the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. The 2018 beekeeping season looks like it's finally here. Given what I see driving around this week and what I'll talk about in the local hive report, all signs point to, yes, finally, spring is coming. I feel busy as a one-armed paper hanger lately, trying to keep things in order at the house. Work is pretty steady with new things to look after. We went to a Devils hockey playoff game this past week. Bummed that they did not make it through. Against my common sense judgment, with all the stuff I have going on, I went to opening day with the race team last Saturday. Split five or so carts of firewood, simply have been burning the midnight oil, and oh yeah, been doing a bunch of peripheral tasks in the beekeeping world. This week I updated the Northwest site with an updated calendar of events, processed and posted videos of Bob Kloss's short talk on yellow jacket traps, providing the corresponding info on the Northwest homepage. Wrote a two-page feature on Malawi for the New Jersey Beekeepers newsletter with accompanying photos. Created a Waterwalk sponsorship page for the upcoming fundraiser. MC'd the Northwest March meeting Friday night. And, well, you get the picture. Several other things were in the mix, and as I've said, I've been keeping myself busy lately. I love and hate that every square moment of my existence is occupied, so at times I just chill out. Sharon and I ate lunch today in our gazebo, and Tiger the Bee Cat and Julia our dog kept us company. It was a glorious day out today and full of potential. That is somewhat what the theme of this episode is. It's about getting up if you fall down. It's about planning your destiny. It's about having fun and smelling the roses as you move along in life. That, I guess, is a little squishy, so let me be more specific and share with you the agenda for the show. In the opening, we'll talk about neonics in the EU, what's going on with that. Failure is quitting on something you love. Topic number three, getting ahead of Varroa. I'm going to mention what a cloak board is and why you would want to use one. I'm going to talk about the microscope meeting that I mentioned a moment ago. And a short little blurb on BT in Hopewell. Also in the closing comments, just a couple words about the sound mix. So, lots and lots to do. Let's go ahead and get started. First up, Local Hive Report. Local Hive Report. There is something magical about the smell of honey, comb, propolis on your hands. Smells so good. I love getting into hives. And I'm sick and tired of saying we'll have to wait till we get in our hives to tell you what's happened. I suppose I'll share just as a short side note. I feel like the assessment overwinter success this season is not good. Just not happy with it. It sucks. I am not, nor will I ever be satisfied with winter losses in the percentages that we had this year. But this episode's about potential, and so I'm moving on and I feel like a beekeeper again. And I'm putting all that behind me. Last week we finally had a warm day on Saturday. One warm enough to crack the hives open, check the hives, but then we had to button them up again because come Sunday it cooled off and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday we were back into overnight temperatures in the 30s. Last Saturday the morning started with a prep of the full hive super. I had looked it over when someone gave it to me. But I wanted to make sure before I put it on that when you put that long screwdriver style tool into it and turn it, that the mechanism would work and each of the frames would open properly. I just wanted to inspect each one of the super frames and make sure they were right. And actually, I did discover on the back of each of the frames is a little set screw. And the set screw seems to hold the super into the box a specific way, and it was screwed out too far, and the frames were pushing far too much towards the spout end of the design. And so it was able to dial them back a little bit, but for the most part, everything looked good, all the plugs were in, and the super was ready to go. I started the hive inspections, and of the five that survived, all of the hives have laying queens, and four of the five are booming, and the fifth, the polystyrene hive, scared me. If you watch our YouTube, if you're subscribed to Northwest Channel, you will see the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association. I posted a bunch of these videos of the inspections I'm going to talk about. Unfortunately, I started with the nuke. I was pretty sure it did not survive that last cold snap, and looking through it, I was right. Darn. If we had turned the corner a couple weeks ago, that hive would have survived. It was that close. It just simply did not have enough bees. I probably should have taken some sort of action. I don't know. You know, you could second guess that all the time. I started with the polystyrene hive, and I shot a video of this, and it's out there for everyone to see. I took the top two boxes off, the honey supers, with the assumption that they were full of honey. That's how I put them in. They were really light, and I didn't think much of it other than they must have eaten all the honey, and I put them aside. There was two deeps and two honey supers, which are equivalent of mediums on that hive, and I started into the top deep expecting to find the brood there. I went through frame. I was on the other side of the hive, so I went through 8, 7, 6, 5, got to the middle, and they were empty frames, not a lot to see. I got to 4, and I'm doing this by memory, but I think there was like a patch of brood, but it was old and emerged. And then I started seeing some bees and some smidge of pollen and smidge of nectar stored, but nothing there. And on either frame 3 or 2, there was a queen milling around like nothing's going on, you know. And looking at it, it made no sense. I was really thought I was in trouble. You know, here's a queen. She's not laying. She's got bees milling around. Maybe she's still giving off queen pheromone. That's what I was thinking. But for whatever reason, she's not laying. It was an inclination of maybe she's not ready yet, because it's still too cold and she's carniolian and she's going to get ready when she's ready. But still something didn't sit right. And if you watch the video, you'll see there's a moment. I captured it and freeze framed it. I had a moment. It's winter time. Where would the bees be? In the top of the hive. I took the top of the hive and set it aside. So I went and looked in there, and I probably got 3 frames in and found a frame of brood, and crisis averted, but it scared the out of me. And, you know, as seasoned a beekeeper as I am, this is our 10th season, you still every once in a while, especially coming out of winter, have to shake the cobwebs off. But I've run that hive several years now, and they've never made it up into the honey supers. So I thought that was rather interesting. Anyway, the hive doing okay. Went and checked the other hives. Everything looked good. And I put the flow hive super on top of the box, buttoned everything up. And really what I was doing was I crack the box, tip it up, look for queen cells, look at the population, see where the brood was if I could find it. Kevin moment. I rode to the races with my brother Keith the other day, and he said to me, "You don't get it for new people. You talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk." And he's not a beekeeper, but he just happens to listen to the show every once in a while to pass the time. He said, "Brood. What is brood? What is it? What's brood? What is it? Brood this, brood, 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 brood. You never say what that is." I said to him, "Dear brother, This is a beekeeping podcast. Most people have the basic lexicon of beekeeping terms down. But for those who are spanking brand new and are not familiar with that term, on this occasion I will tell you that brood refers to the nest where the new bees are growing and where the nurse bees that take care of the eggs that turn into real bees. That's the brood area. It's referred to as brood. Okay, my conscience is clean. And Keith, I hope you like that. I'm moving on. So the brood area. All I wanted to see was some form of pattern and sign of eggs. I didn't really need to find the queen, although I did find the queen in a couple of the hives. And things look pretty good. So I said my hands smell like hives today. Went back into the hives with a mission. I wanted to do mite checks. And I anticipated that I was going to put on Mite Away quick strips. That leads baits the witness, Your Honor, because I'm going to tell you what happened. I went in the polystyrene hive, curious to see how it progressed over the week. And oh my, she has been busy. All the frames in the top that I looked at, loaded with eggs, larvae. Little worms. I mean, they progressed through the full week, 6 days old. So she must have been like laying like crazy. Down in the top, deep, there were four frames loaded with eggs. It looked spectacular. I went to pull a frame to do a mite check. I was doing alcohol washes. I am being Boy Scout this year. I'm going to do my mite checks. And I was looking at doing the first treatment, if need be, and lo and behold, zero mites. I'm shocked. I'm like, I had to play it back in my head. Did I pull the right frame? Was it really brood? Were those nurse bees? The first frame I pulled, I went to look at it, and I looked at the one side, and then I looked at the other side, and I looked at the side again, and I went back to the other side, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, if the queen's ever going to be somewhere, she's there. Sharon was there taking a couple photographs with our camera. And I said, Sharon, see any queen here? Come help me, keep me honest. She goes, there's a queen. Spotted her right away. So needless to say, I put that one back. Pulled the next one next to it. And did a mite wash and zero mites. So that was a little surprise. A little surprise for me. I was not anticipating that. Now, if I remember back, late last year, November time frame, I did an oxalic treatment on that hive. And maybe, who knows, I zapped all the mites prior to going into winter and they've been having a kumbaya moment in there. Who knows? So I moved to the next hive. Same scenario. Pulled the frame. Looked good. This hive loaded both boxes. Lots of population. Looks great. Pulled a brood frame, did a mite wash. Zero. No mites. Same story. It got an oxalic treatment. So I'm two for two. I'm loving that. Now that hive, I went back later and put a honey super on it because as I went through the top boxes, it's two deeps. I went again backwards. Usually what happens, let me explain this. If you stand behind the hive, I almost always approach the hive from behind and left. And because of the way the light was shining from the sun and I was shooting some camera, I was behind and to the right. When I count my frames, behind and to the left is frame 1, 2, 3, all the way to 10 or 9, depending on how many frames I'm running in the hive. And in this case, I was standing on the other side, so I worked backwards from 9, 8, 7, 6, and so on, just like I explained before on the polyhive. When I got to 7, it was loaded with nectar and some capped honey. When I got to 6, it was loaded with nectar and even more capped honey. When I got to 5, it was half and half. When I got to 4, 3, 2, full sheets, capped honey all the way through. This hive, somehow, some way, they've been getting it done. They're ready to go. So they had loaded that entire top box with honey. And it's not overwintered honey, because what I could see is the farthest frames out had overwintered honey, maybe stuff that I fed them. It was dark, walked on wax. This was fresh, clean, bright, oh my, I love spring wax on that honey. It looked great. Full frames, full size deeps. So needless to say, I had to make a spare trip, not anticipating it, but didn't mind, to go and get a honey super and put it on. Really, what I probably should have done, although I do anticipate there's a couple more cold nights before we finally hit that stride. And one of the things I'm really looking for here is, when will we get to the overnight temperature warm enough where they don't have to cluster, meaning above 45 or 50 degrees? We're not there yet. The forecast isn't there for the full week coming up. So I don't want to go crazy putting tons of boxes on there. There's still time. But as I drive around the neighborhood, I see that the flowering trees are flowered. They're bloom. They're full blown. And it's really a weird spring. All the plants think it's full bonanza spring, but the temperature has been suppressed. Not sure what that means, and we'll see what kind of spring this is going to end up being. So anyway, that hive looks great. Two full boxes of bees, a new honey super on the top, and they're storing honey like it's going out of style. Moving to yard one, that was yard two, I walked right past the Waré hive. If you watch the Waré hive, which is the feature video on the Northwest site, you'll see it's doing great. It's just going to town. If I'd have opened it today, my guess is they're pushing down into the bottom box, which they had built comb, but they had abandoned it late in the season because it was too cold. I went to the hive that is the citizen hive, that you can look at the weight and the temperatures. Note to self, I changed the complete configuration both last Saturday and today, Sunday, so that when you're watching the weight is going to jump really high last Saturday. That's when I put the flow frame on. And then the weight is going to change again today because I changed the configuration. Of which I am a Boy Scout. I've taken my notes out and tracked all that, what hive manipulations I've done on my inspection sheets. So for the flow hive, that hive, as noted last week, when I looked at it on that warm day, there were so many bees, they had just covered the entire outer surface. They're screaming swarm. If it wasn't so early and they didn't have drones and they had queen cells, they'd probably be swarming on any other given year. But this year, they're a little behind. Now, I added the flow hive super, and when I went into it today, there was a handful of bees, but not a lot up there. My understanding from asking around on that thing is you need to have a banging hive for them to want to push up and use it. But I did something counter. So last week, when I posted the video of putting the flow box on there, I got responses back, thank you, from people who follow us on YouTube or and their potential listeners who said, you put it on backwards. I didn't get any instructions with it. I got a box. And so lo and behold, I went and took a look on the Flow Hive site. And yeah, I did it wrong. What do I know about Flow Hive? What's supposed to happen is the front faces the back of the hive. And the point of that is the little ports where you plug in the tubes in order to let the honey flow out into the jar, like the magic video. You obviously want them going out the back of the hive so you're not standing in the bees leaving. And I never thought about it. I just took the box and, you know, truth be told, when I look at my Waré hives, the windows are on the front of the hive. And so when I put that there and I had the windows open, I thought it went to the front. Just naturally did the same thing. Nope, goes to the back. So today it was to right that wrong. So I had objectives, and this was the other thing that I did very well, pat myself on the back. I had objectives for what I wanted to do today. I wanted to do a mite check. I wanted to Add a box. Another piece of feedback that I got was that the proper way to use a flow hive is to put a queen excluder below it. I have heard year after year after year that a queen excluder is a honey excluder. So it seems really super counterintuitive to me to do that. Just counterintuitive. However, I'm not going to fight City Hall. So I know the box is really populated. They need more space. And one of the things I want to do is get an all-medium hive going again. So I brought an all-medium box, and I put it in the stack. And one of the other things was this hive was sitting on my hive stand that was made for my top bar hive, which I want to put in service, so I need that back. So I took one of my BK corner hive stands and put it on pad number 4. I put a piece of plywood on it. I moved the hive around so that I could get the broodminder scale and the 2x4 block and put it down on top of that. And then I put a solid bottom board. And like I've been talking about, I took the screen bottom board and put it on top of that. I put the medium super next. And then I put the two deeps. I put a queen excluder. And I put the flow box on top in the wrong direction. Allowed bees to pass up through it, then realized I did it wrong and had to turn it around. And one of the things that I remembered to do, and hopefully I didn't screw this up, there was a smidge of a risk, which I'll talk about. The bees were up into the flow box. That means the queen could have been up there. If I put the queen excluder underneath and it gets cold tonight, which it's going to, all the bees will go down, but the queen would be stuck up in there. So I took the time to pull every one of the flow frames out to look and see whether the queen was on any of them. And while I did, I could see into the woodenware and determine whether or not there was any queen on the sides, and I'm pretty good about spotting them. Could I have missed her? Maybe, but not likely. It's highly unlikely she was up there. But then again, they don't read the books. They could be on the inner cover for all you know. So I rolled the dice, but my risk is really very low. And I did end up turning that hive around, that box around, to have it on properly. But one of the things I'll say about the flow frame, there's little knobs on the top of the box over top of the viewport area, and when you put an inner cover on and then an outer cover, the outer cover sit on those knobs. So I used two inner covers to get the outer cover to come up so it wasn't sitting crooked. That's kind of weird. I'm not sure if there's something wrong there. But at the end of the day, the box is all set, and I'm hoping the bees will be happy. And let me talk about the under supering that I did. That's what you call it when you have two boxes, and instead of adding boxes on top, I added the medium underneath. So the medium is an under super, and the flow box is a super, meaning on top. Under super, pretty common with Waray hives, is called natering. The reason I put it down there is my impression of the queen is eventually they'll build a honey dome at the top and she'll push the brood chamber down into the boxes. The second thing is I didn't want to put it on top between the brood chamber and the honey super for the flow frame, because then they'll put it in that box and they'll never make it up to the flow hive, and I want to have the flow hive filled. Third aspect of this is it's still cold, so the bees are going to be up in the top of the box. And what I'm looking for is for them to be up, and that will give a buffer above the bottom board. But eventually, when it warms up, they'll push down. I don't know if I'm overthinking this. It's possible. But I used logic through the whole thing, and that's the hive configuration that I came up with. Now, talking about the final hive, the Gateway Hive, which is three deeps. It's three deeps. And the population, the top box was full when I looked at it last Saturday. And I could see the second box look like the population was down about halfway. But most of them were in the top box at the end of winter. That box lost 20 pounds over winter. It looks like a pound and a half a week. I've been measuring it on my grain scale. And looking at it this week, it went down again another pound. Now, one of the things I know about them is they have reasonable flying weather now. 55, 60 degrees, I could tell by the camera and just looking around, you know, when I get home at night, that bees are flying. Next to it are hives that didn't make it through. And the one hive that I picked up today that I moved, it had to weigh 100 pounds. It's got so much honey. And it had, I know why some of these hives don't have a lot of bees in them, because they're robbing the other ones out. In my estimation, that's okay. I'm going to let them do it. If I thought they would pick up something evil, I wouldn't let them do it. But I've been through my dead outs already, and I'm positive that I know why they died, and they pose no risk to my live hives. If you do have dead outs, you should have sealed them off, and you should have gone through them to make sure that they didn't have something nefarious before you figured out what you're going to do with them. But in my case, I'm okay with them. And in short order, like next week or the week after, given the population of some of these hives, I'm going to start making splits and putting them back in those boxes is my plan. I think by next week, we should start hitting warmer weather. Wow. It feels so good to be in bees again. I went through the whole day. Well, I should say, I walked out to yard number two. I rolled my new cart. I should talk about that. Santa brought me a cart. A big honking cart with nice wheels. I've been using this little plastic thing. If you've ever seen any of the videos, it's broken in the bottom. The wheels are like, there was so much weight that the axle is bent and the wheels are tilted. It looks like a clown car. So my lovely Santa honey purchased me a real honest-to-goodness industrial-style cart, and I used it today for the first time. It was very nice. Very, very nice. So I wheeled the cart out. I stopped it. I walked over, stood in front of the hive. I was there for about 6 seconds, and bang, got stung on the arm. Don't know what I did to deserve it. Just no warning. Boom. I went through the entire session last weekend and this weekend, working the bees, no problems. Everything was good. I should say that I wore this white, I don't know what you call them, nylon, the new style material. I've had this shirt for a long time. It was one that Sharon bought a long time ago for scouting, and it's one of my favorite shirts to work bees in. It's lightweight, it's cool, but it's long sleeve, and yeah, you can get stung through it, but for the most part, I've had pretty good luck with it. And over top of that, I wore the new bib-style helmet device that I bought. I like it. Oh, yeah, I like it. I'm really digging that thing. The new jacket that I had, Sharon wore that both times. She was out both times with me, and she said it was really comfortable. And last week, it was 80 degrees, maybe a little hotter than that. And I said to her, do you feel the breeze blowing through? And she did. She was really, really happy with that. So anyway, today, finished up, happy as a lark, strolled down to the driveway, got off the grass, turned right to go up the driveway towards the house, and got stung on the neck. Just out of nowhere. It's not like bees were following me or anything like that. I had taken my vest, hood, veil combo thing off, packed all my equipment away, standing in and amongst the bees, put everything back, put the smoker in the cart, wheeled myself down, got to the driveway, and boom, got stung. So, go figure. I don't know. I don't know if she followed me or she just decided, there he is, I'm going to get him. So local hive report. Happy days. Love being in bees. Check. Let's go ahead and get to segment number one. Topic number one. Topic number one, EU neonic update. Patrick McCallaman, a listener from Andalusia, Alabama, wrote me an email recently and shared that he's been listening to past episodes, and a question struck him about some topics from the 2013 timeframe about the EU ban of certain neonicotinoid pesticides. In those episodes, episode 40 and 41, per Patrick's sleuthing, I made a statement something to the fact that it would be interesting to come back in time and see how this all turns out. I did try to get some insight on how that worked. At one point, I knew that the ban was coming up in 2015, and I had made some inquiries in conversations at conferences over the years from beekeepers from that region, and the general consensus is they could not get a straight answer either. It's kind of like politics, and depending on whether you were decisive about the harm of the pesticides and you were clear that they were evil, or you're an industry zealot and you claimed victory that the science will prove out that these things are fine and you people are making too much of this. Beekeeping researchers and advocates cite information that has since been released that vindicates that neonics are harmful, and that the ban was righteous, and that they will be vindicated any time now. While companies like Bayer and those who see neonics as a valuable tool for farmers came out on the side that it was hogwash, and that important resources are being withheld from the farmers, and they've done the science, and these products are safe when used as directed. I specifically tried to find out the insights about the renewal of the ban, which was set to conclude in 2015, but ran out of energy trying to get a straight answer. There are sites on the internet like Friends of the Earth and other such organizations that claimed victory after 2015 and indicated that the lawmakers have agreed that neonics are harmful and a full ban was imminent any time now. The point is, it is somewhat hard to find the truth about what was going on as a result of all the outcomes. To be clear, one could visit the European Food Safety Authority and check and see what was going on, the EFSA. And this organization has finally declared that neonics are harmful. What is not clear is what meaningful outcomes are going to occur as a result. And I said finally, it should be noted that, as an aside, this information, the declaration of findings from the EFSA, was literally just released to the public in the form of a press release on February 28th of this year, about 3 years after the test period of banning certain uses expired. And up until the press release was posted, the findings were unclear and beekeepers have kind of been in limbo since 2015. It states, and this is from the press release at the EFSA website, most uses of neonicotinoid pesticides represent a risk to wild bees and honeybees, according to assessments published today by EFSA. The authority has updated its risk assessments of three neonicotinoids, clothianidine, imidacloprid, and thiamethoxam, that are currently subject to restrictions in the EU because of the threat they pose to bees. It's interesting to note that the headline of the press release is "Neonicotinoids Risks to Be Confirmed." That's kind of an odd statement for a press release that in the body seems to indicate conclusive evidence of harm. It kind of says, yes, we found out these things are harmful, but we're not going to say what we're going to do with it. To cut to the chase, perhaps it's the EFSA's job to simply decide if it's harmful or not and leave it up to others to figure out what to do, and hence the squishy title. There is evidence of this idea in the statement of what comes next. It says, quote, EFSA's conclusions will be shared with risk managers from the European Commission and member states, who will consider potential amendments to the current restrictions on the use of these pesticides, end quote. As an aside, my understanding is, even though the 2015 deadline came and went, it can be inferred that the ban remained in place while they took the time to assess and decide. I don't know that for true, but it's my impression that the original bans were left in place, and now with this information shared, it's plausible that it will go even further. If you take a look at the websites out on the interwebs, like The World is Coming to an End Because of Humans.com. If it wasn't clear, I made that up, by the way. These type of advocate websites have already concluded that all neonicotinoids are evil and should just be banned outright. Skeptical as it is that it will go that direction, that far, but let's see where the EFSA and their partners go with this. And one might have a curiosity, what exactly did the EFSA report on it in its findings? They did go into a smidge of detail in the press release. I'll summarize quickly what was an example of a deciding factor that they did publish as part of their share of the findings to the public. It said, in the case of oilseed rape crops, they provide in a table that indicates how much risk they discovered. Number one, risk of exposure to honeybees by residues in nectar and pollen from treated crops are low. Risk of exposure to honeybees by residues via drift is high. Risk of exposure to bumblebees by residues in nectar and pollen from treated crops is high. These examples that they shared were focused on Bayer's imidacloprid product. And it seems to allude that there is more to the story, but we're left with this little representative example of what they found, and they'll be passing along the remainder of it for the others to consider. In some respects, it kind of sounds like I'm being critical. I should state for the record that I'm not. But I have to say I'm frustrated at the slow churn, while being appreciative that I guess they're taking the time it takes to do this well, even if it means us impatient beekeepers are awaiting the proper course of action while trying to get whatever help we can to keep our bees healthy. At the end of the day, though, if this proves to be a no-brainer like DDT was, and they need to stop using it, what aggravates me is that technology and science and communication has not found a way to make things move faster. The results were concluded in 2015, and you had to wait till February 2018 for somebody to parse the data. There's got to be a better way, and in the end, if the world decides these products that are approved were a bad idea, then please let the government be efficient enough to come to the conclusion quickly, now that they have the data, and then act swiftly and take the right course of action. I go back to saying we should keep in mind that the DDT in the U.S. was called out for problems in the late 1950s, and it was not banned for use until 1973. I'm hoping that science, these quote-unquote modern times, can use technology more efficiently, evaluate, to get an answer quicker than that, at least. It's, you know. Anyway, Patrick, thanks for the note. It motivated me to poke around a little more for an update. And until I looked, I was not aware that the cited press release was out there, and the timing was perfect. I'm glad to have learned more about the fate of what was pondered back in 2013. And I do appreciate the reminder of taking a look at it. I'll share one other inside baseball thing on this. I had one of those nights where I fell asleep at like 8 o'clock at night. And when I do that, I won't make it past 3 a.m. And I woke up at 3 a.m. and I saw Patrick's note about this. And at 3 in the morning, I'm looking it up. And I found all the response and I wrote this little segment that you just listened to. And I was so appreciative of Patrick spurring this inquiry on that I sent him the draft of this in an email as a response. When he got up in the morning after writing that, he had the inside baseball answer to his question. I'd never done that before. I thought that was kind of funny. So, Patrick, thanks. That was a first for me, too. All right. I'll provide links, of course, in the show notes to some of the information I've talked about. Topic number two, title of this one is Failure is Quitting Something You Love. The other day I posted videos of my first hive inspection, as I said before. Inspections which I actually had a hive tool in my hand and pried boxes apart from one another. Sharon came out to the yard with me and she used my iPhone to shoot videos that we were going to post. And all the while, as I was doing inspections and we were shooting video, I was excited to see how the hives were doing, but there was a little tension that prevented it from being totally enjoyable experience. In thinking back, I've been harboring a guilt that I'm going to come clean with so I can move along with life. And along the way, I'm going to see if I can help some of you out of a jam also. So what was the genesis of that tension? In the videos, the ones where I'm going through my full hives, it's evidence. Other hives around that I don't talk about. My inner voice is recounting to me that in the local hive reports, I recounted 12 hives going into winter. And after losing a nuke in the last few weeks, it came down to 5 surviving. Those are just terrible numbers for someone, especially who has been doing this for so long, and for someone portraying guidance to others. If I know what I'm doing, then all of you out there are asking, why am I not having better success? I'm reading, or better said, listening to an audiobook by Daniel Crissa called Your Inner Critic is a Big Jerk. Actually, I just finished it yesterday. The premise of her book, she is apparently an artist, is to do what you love and how to handle the manic inner voice that's always battling against you. Her voice somewhat reminds me of the movie Julie and Julia. She has a similar tone of the actress, I don't know her name, in that movie. And her patter is similar, just the same kind of flat, soft tone. Anyway, the book itself, listening to the audiobook, is just okay on the whole. But instead of doing a critique, let me take one lesson and share it here as it applies to what was the genesis of this topic. In the guise of taking on an activity, she says, failure is quitting something you love. Now, I'm not going to quit, but I want to share something with you. I had that discussion. Yes, that discussion with my inner critic. The one that said between my ears, you know, you're embarrassing yourself. You put in all this effort, you talk and you talk about this stuff, and still, you come out of spring and your hives are not alive. What right do you have spouting chapter and verse? Yeah, that's the truth. The inner critic said this to me just recently. You know, you could just throw in the towel, pull the plug on this, and go find something else you're good at. You're embarrassing yourself. That might come off as, sure, these things happen to all of us, or wow, I had no idea Kevin, could feel that way. So now I'll step back from the ledge and share where I went with all of this. Excuses aside, I will state emphatically that sometimes I'm just too sloppy, too experimental, a little scattered, a smidge lazy, a smidge frenetic, or I simply have too many things going on and need focus. On the other hand, many of the most creative, successful people live pretty messy lives behind the scenes, or are overachievers, and even if some things don't work out, the better part of what they produce works. I'm hoping I'm in that category. I don't know yet. Life will judge me later. So I went through a phase where I wanted to know in absolute, do you really have to feed bees? The answer is yes when they need it. That didn't work out well. Yellow jackets, they're a real problem, and we'll take your hives down. Never knew that until I learned it, and then I know it. Learned that lesson a few years ago. Last year, I learned the hard way that using Apivar packages that were previously opened is a serious error, and you cannot come back from that. Each year, over the years we've been doing this, something's learned. And damn it, failures come with the territory, and I'm sick of them. I really am. I'm sick of them. It sure seems like others around me have better outcomes, and that honestly bothers me. And it gives all the ammunition in the world for that inner critic. Holy cow, can that inner critic be harsh? So now to the title of this topic. Failure is quitting something you love. I do love beekeeping, and throwing in the towel would be a colossal mistake. I sometimes recognize that I'm a better podcaster about beekeeping than I am a beekeeper. And in response to my inner critic, I am listening. So there's a smidge of a secret in your inner critic. Is there is a grain of truth in there. Don't listen to the bully, but do something about the message that comes underneath in the undertone, the root cause. Sometimes the criticism is warranted, but quite frankly, I'm not in the habit of letting my inner critic guide my life, especially when the voice is cruel. But I do use it to guide me, you know, to do what you should do when hearing that little voice in your head, be critical, find a way to improve. So to those who had an overwinter success, let me give you a pat on the back. Good for you. I am genuinely happy for you. Hopefully you'll be genuinely happy for me when I have my successes and I tell you about them. I'm genuinely envious and thank you for being a good role model and helping to light the way. And I'm hoping you're sharing your insights and guidance with others. To those who, like me, on occasion encounter difficulties and didn't achieve the outcomes you wish to have, do me a favor, lean in. Unless you are creeped out by this, here's a virtual hug. I'm giving you one. A pat on the back if you don't want a hug. A smile and a nod. That's right. We are smart. We are well-meaning, and we promise to make and take the actions required to turn our outcomes into successes. We learn. Failure is a means to learn. We're in this together, and quitting would be a failure. So channel any frustrations into evaluating what happened. Make the necessary course corrections. Sharing another quote from the audiobook, it's a bit cliche, but here goes. Success is only before work in the dictionary. And I find that kind of prophetic. In my case, as I've just shared, and in these days, it seems to always be about mites. I'm going to finally throw in the towel and get front and center on monitoring and treatment 3 times a year. I also communicated to Sharon in a roundabout way that the commitment and discipline for these activities are going to have to be prioritized. And I am well aware that the honey-do list and that things have to be scheduled for beekeeping, even in lieu of the honey-do list, in order to achieve success. So I'm doing this in cooperation with my obligation as a beekeeper and to good animal husbandry. And there's going to be some tedious battles over time commitments. I guess I could see that coming, but commitment, once you've made it, is important in the formula and it adds up to success. Yeah. Isn't it ironic that I did my mite checks today, and as you heard in the local hive report, there's no mites. No need to treat in the spring. I was all so gung-ho about this, but I am still proud of myself that I brought my hive inspection sheets out, and I made notes and tracked all that. And I even shot a video of it, which in time I will post. So, yeah, maybe this is a bit of, I don't know, what do you call this? What do you refer to it as? Trying to give myself a pass on something? Oh, that's my inner critic talking. Shut up, inner critic. Okay, let's move on. So as I start, I want to make sure that I give some context of the conversation. I'm in New Jersey, where beekeepers, you throw a rock and you can hit one. No one wants to treat, even us in New Jersey. It's expensive, it's time-consuming, it's not a lot of fun, and it's a tremendous amount of drain on resources. But in New Jersey, it's likely that the thresholds will dictate you do something if you subscribe to that line of thinking. The fact of the matter is mites kill colonies. Impacts are easily understood. Bees have a shorter lifespan. Smaller populations mean less honey, less nutrition, less hive activity. Absconding in hives that are overrun is a possibility. But the key thing is hives simply do not overwinter when carrying virus loads and dealing with other impacts of having mites in the hive. And there are several treatments available. Apivar is currently the darling. And from an effectiveness standpoint, it kills a high percentage of mites. There are other things that you could use that are considered soft chemicals. And there are, of course, different use cases that make certain ones suitable on different conditions and certain hive states. And as a refresher, you need to switch things up and kill resistant mites. You must not use the same treatment time and time again, as the mites that survive are going to breed resistance. There are four main considerations when thinking about your mite treatment options. The first one is timing. It means a lot of different things, but in this case I'll call out, you have to know how long the treatments are and what the conditions are related to whether you have honey supers on, whether it's getting cold, and all of those things. Honey protection, don't poison anyone with this stuff. Don't taint your honey. You have to consider temperature, number three. Don't gas your bees by putting it on when it's so hot that the product releases too much and it kills your queen or damages your brood. And on the other side, it has to be warm enough for it to be effective. And you have to consider the state of your colony at any given point. And I'll come back to this in a minute. But does it have brood? Is it capped? Is it uncapped? What are the number of bees? Are they on the cluster? All of these things factor into which treatment is the right option, or whether a treatment is the right option. If you think about seasonal change, while it's been unusual here in New Jersey, usually between March and April 15th, hives can be opened on some warmer days. Bees are on the cluster and just opening up. So whatever treatment you have has to take into consideration those states. April 15th to August 31st in New Jersey, it's game on. There's active honey flow in most of our area through to about mid-July, and temperatures are probably more a concern if they exceed thresholds for using products than being too cold, but you can use pretty much whatever you wish with the considerations that I said earlier, because I don't want that to be misconstrued. September 1st to October 15th, it's the fall honey flow for many of us, but it's also when they're building winter bees, and you do not want to impact the growth of the colony and population at that time. If you put some of these treatments on as a use case, they may stop the queen from laying. It's a bad time to have the queen laying when she's trying to lay the winter bees that are going to overwinter for you. I'll say October 15th to November 30th, the hive is closing down for fall. There's less capped brood. Bees that are being built in the nest may be more phoretic. And then, of course, you have the period from November 30th, when it starts to get to that first frost, all the way back to the beginning of March, where you're in winter. Bees are on the cluster. There tends to be very little, if no, brood at that period of time, and certain treatment options make sense. I've danced around this a little bit, and now I'm going to talk about it directly. You have to give consideration that hive populations swing. Hives grow, they maintain steady state, and they contract. And whatever is going on in those periods, you have to consider that when you're doing your treatments. To be more illustrative, this time of year in my hives, the bees are going to outbreed the mites. But then again, the mites are going to follow them on a similar trajectory. Then you get to summertime, and the bees will lose their nectar flow, and you'll go into the summer dearth. The queen will lay off laying, and the population will dive for the bees. But the mites, they're still huge population, no reason to stop. It's not like they're being fed by honey, and they're going to outbreed the bees. So you want to look at high population swings when you're considering what your game plan is. This time of year, a lot of you are going, well, wait, what about nukes and packages that I'm going to install or just recently installed? Should I be treating them? I didn't think about this, or maybe I have and I have an answer, or I'm not sure what to do, so I'm not here. Look, first, ask your provider, did they treat or what was the deal? Because if they treated, you don't want to treat again. The common wisdom used to be no need to treat. But those days are past. Hopefully your provider has taken care of this. But I know from the state apiarist discussion, he's an advocate of sometimes just giving them a little boost and making sure they're mite-free to start their new journey in life. And a really healthy colony builds out quickly. And that's what you need that first year. You want your bees to come full song so that they can get to the best that they can be to overwinter. So you might consider treating them out of the gate for packages again after you've asked your provider and make the right decision. Kevin moment. I read something recently, I think it was Jennifer Berry that spoke of this, that when they set up their new packages, they treat them with oxalic acid, but not vaporization and not drips. They mix oxalic in sugar spray and spray the packages. I don't know what the formula is. I got to look that up and figure out how that works. But supposedly it gives them a good head start. And of course, after all, they're broodless. So if you kill all the mites riding on the bees, yeah, that's an interesting idea. It's one that I had a footnote on, but I figured I'd mention it. And there is a strong recommendation for those of you that are new to learn what it means to monitor and take samples and understand thresholds. And if you get later in the year and you find that the number of mites per bees sampled exceed the thresholds, do consider treatment going into winter to give your hive the best chance and your investment of surviving. I'm not going to go into how to do mite treatments and all that stuff, but the YouTube channel that I gave you earlier has a lot of stuff on that. YouTube.com/NWNJBA. Look for the alcohol wash video from state apiarist Schuler. So one of the questions you might have is, should I treat prophylactically? No. And surprisingly, I'm going to say yes. And I'll explain myself. No. We're not advocates of treating for the sake of treating. You should treat because you have a reason to treat. Your thresholds indicate that you are over. So I could have, as you heard in the local hive report, just cracked my hives open for spring, prophylactically thrown mite away quick strips in there, and treated my hives. I didn't do that because I don't believe in that. I don't want to treat if I don't have to. So I monitored my mites, found out my thresholds were not conducive to that, and I took the mite away quick strips that I spent my cold hard cash on, and I put it back in a cabinet for some other day. Now I come to say yes, and I'll give my asterisks on that. We're advocates of monitoring and treating if thresholds warrant. If one or several of your hives, if you have multiple, if you're new you probably don't, but if you do, are over the threshold, then trade them all. Treat them all. Because chances are the bees are drifting if you have them nearby. And you don't want to treat your good ones, the ones, sorry, let me say that differently. You don't want to treat the ones and have them get in good shape, only to be overwhelmed later by the other ones that you didn't bother to treat. Now, if you get to the situation where you know you've literally done checks on all of them, and you want to go down the path of just treating the ones that were over the threshold, I guess that's okay, but just, you know, think through that. If the bees are drifting and the mites are leaving and they're going in the other hives, well, that could be a recipe for disaster. I'm only pointing out the information. You can make your decisions on how to go on that. So in that presentation that I spoke of a few moments ago, I walked through an example of a treatment year. I thought, you know, these concepts are all great, but the reality, and I saw this from Landy Simone, actually, at a Chester conference. She said, this is how I do it. And she wasn't telling you the recipe. She just said, this is an example of a year. And I did the same thing. I presuppose certain conditions for spring, summer, fall, and winter. And then talked about the four conditions that I gave you earlier. Whether there's honey on, what the population is, and those things. And it gave a sample treatment plan for a year. And walked around different considerations for making decisions. I also discussed alternatives that might be employed along the way. And a sneaky little thing about whether you should ever use Apivar twice. You'll have to watch a video because, again, I'd like to move on. I got a lot of stuff to cover here. The curve. I'll close with the concept of the curve, and I wanted to make sure that everybody knew this because I think it's probably one of the more important concepts of mite treatments. So let me spend a moment on this. I said this earlier, and I'm going to repeat it, but then I'll expand upon it. In the springtime, when the nectar flow is going, your queen is going to town. She's got all the clues that have her laying tons and tons of eggs and building brood like a fiend. There's also the dynamic of she's trying to get to the optimal point of swarming and casting off to do her job, and she's building a lot of drones. Drones harbor mites. When you have drones, they incubate longer, they make more mites, your mite population goes up. That's why one of the reasons people do drone culling is that's an integrated pest management to lessen the number of mites in your hive. But the lesson here is the better the colony does, the stronger the colony is, the more potential for mites. And it goes all the way through the nectar flow and it gets to early summer. And depending on where you are, you either lose or keep going, but we'll talk about New Jersey. Our bees ramp down about July 4th, and by the time August comes, they're just hanging down waiting for the September 1st time frame when signs of fall foliage and goldenrod asters come in. The queen stops laying, and if you watch a hive on a weekly basis, you could literally see the population drop. But the mites that are in the cells are a promissory note that, wow, I'm going to have a lot of mites. When the queen stops laying, all the mites come out of the cells and they're on all the bees. And this is a great time to consider treatment if you have high thresholds because they call it phoretic mite. Phoretic means the mite is hitching a ride on the bee itself. Well, if the mite is on the bee and you do a treatment that comes in contact with the mite, they're not in underneath the cap cell, it's an ideal time to get them. Now going back to the spring concept, what I didn't mention is the new idea is they always used to tell you to treat in the summertime, this time period that I'm discussing, and then make sure going into winter your bees are in good shape and maybe you get mite bombs. Hives that are overloaded with mites that abscond, and they come and they meld with your hive, and your your hive, which was in good shape all year long, all of a sudden has a overload of mites in the fall, and you come back to spring and go, what the heck happened? This hive was great. Well, think about what we said. You're at the end of the nectar flow. Your hive has a huge population. Your queen stops laying. There's less capped brood. The mites are coming out, and all your bees have mites riding on them. If you do treatments then and kill the mites, the bees that have emerged, they're yesterday's news. They're going to be going by the way of Mother Earth, right? Because in a couple weeks, they'll be flying out and going to their demise. When the queen starts to lay again, if the mite load is not there, the new emerging bees through August, September, October, those rounds of bees, every 21 days a worker emerges, they'll be a lot healthier and they'll build a better population going into winter. Now, I talk about this all the time, but it bears repeating and reminding that you have to monitor your bees and do not wait till September or October. I mentioned it earlier is where I went wrong last year is I put my Apivar treatments in July when I saw the mite thresholds were high. It was right here at this moment that I'm discussing where the curve went up and started to come down, and I did what I was supposed to. Unfortunately, the Apivar I used was old, and I'm thinking to myself, why did the hives that survived made it through and the ones that didn't? And I'm wondering if I seem to recall I had some packages that were old and one container of new, and maybe this is what happened in the mix. I don't know. It's too late to wonder about that. So help me. I'm mind-melding you. The curve. You have to understand the curve. If you didn't treat in the spring, and you're not going to treat in the spring, you need to get in at the end of June, early July, or depending on when that curve happens for you, and monitor your mite thresholds. And if you see high mites, you want to take care of that so when the queen kicks in to lay again, she's going to have non-parasitized bees, bees that are not impacted by varroa on them inside the cell, and when they emerge, they're sick. Okay. Can you tell I'm a little passionate about this? Yeah. All right. That's it. That's all there is to this. I'm going to leave it at that. I hope you learned something. If it's a reminder, sorry if you're sick of hearing it. But, you know, I say this in the beginning. Beekeeping a lot of these right now is about mite keeping, mite varroa management. If you manage your varroa, then you are afforded the luxury of keeping bees. And with that, visit the video if you want to reinforce her and see even more details. And one thing I will say on a plug for the video is that the audience was with me and they asked questions throughout. So if you have questions, maybe they asked them. And if you have any thoughts or suggestions about what I've shared here, please feel free to send a note, kevin@bkcorner.com. Okay, let's go ahead and head to the back of the book. We'll talk about roundtables coming up. Roundtable number one, I want to speak on cloak boards. I spoke to Bob Kloss on the way home tonight. It's Monday night, about 8:30 in the evening. I didn't put this out on Sunday because I had some significant challenges recording Sunday afternoon. So here I am on a Monday night trying to finish everything up. We got on the topic of setting a reservation for the two of us to get together and graft queens. It's an activity that we both wanted to do on our bucket list for 2018. And we set the middle of May to do it. One of the things you do is you graft your queens from eggs that you pick out. And then you put them in a cell builder to have them finished. Let me explain the use of a cloak board, and what I'm talking about will make a little more sense. If you have a full colony, a really good colony that you're going to graft from, you're going to pull out frames and you'll take the eggs and put them in a starter cup. That's as much as I want to say about that. But then you have to put them somewhere where the bees are going to be convinced to turn those eggs in your queen cells, your queen cups, into queens. To create that condition, you split a hive and you take some of the frames and resources along with the bees and you put them above a cloak board and they sit over top of a production colony, meaning a working colony. A cloak board can be described in this way. It's a glorified queen excluder with an addition. Queen excluder is mounted in a frame, and the frame has a slot that you can slide a panel in that separates the bottom hive from the top hive, and a lot of them feature an entrance notch that opens out the back of the hive, so that when you put the bees in the top hive, sitting over top of the cloak board, they exit out the back. Now you have two functional hives, but of course you've brought the frames up to the top one and they have no queen. If they have eggs at their disposal, they'll attempt to build some form of supersedure cells, and you go in and you cull the supersedure cells because you don't want them to raise a queen. And since they cannot make any additional supersedure cells because they have no queen to provide them with eggs, they go queenless. And at that time, you take your starter cells that you've grafted and you put them in this hive and they're readily accepted because they need a queen and they will build you queens all the way throughout. And that's why it's referred to as a cell builder. It's a queen cell builder. That's pretty interesting, right? Kind of not too hard to follow. As the queens get cupped, you pull them out and you put them in a finishing hive and they hatch out and you have new queens. So Bob and I both discussed May 15th or middle, I don't know if that's a Saturday, Sunday, but we're going to get together and do this and probably going to have to remember to order a cloak board and get that set up. What I don't know is, I think what I'll probably end up doing is put this at Bob's house, because I don't know that I could take queens that were recently grafted and drive them, it's not far, but to my house. That's just not going to work. I think you'll disturb them too much, and they need to be grafted and placed in the same yard. So, we'll work that out. But a cloak board, first time I'm ever going to use it, so two milestones at once, grafting queens and use of a cloak board. And a cell builder, for that matter. I've never done that before either. So cool. Looking forward to that. Roundtable number two, I want to talk about the microscope meeting that we had this past Friday. I worked, hustled home from work, threw everything in the vehicle, and headed to Hunterdon Central High School for the postponed March meeting that got hosted here in April. I had been working with Lorette Cheswick for a long time, having a conversation about having a microscope meeting. One, it was unique, and two, I got to see how microscopes worked with bees in a bunch of different ways when we went to EAS. And Lorette, who's retired, she was working with whomever was hosting that session, and we got to discussing that would make a really cool meeting. So one of the things that Lorette has at her disposal, her and her husband are retired researchers, scientists, and they have a wet lab in their property, which is really cool. They do a lot of this type of work, and they're really passionate about it. So they were the perfect folks to host this discussion. They put on a presentation going through a lot of the basics, which I'll tell you about in a second. But when we set the room up, they brought a bunch of different microscopes and a different setups where we had stations that people could go around. And again, I'll come back to that in a second. So the first thing in her talk was talking about you have a microscope at your disposal and you don't even know it. The answer is your iPhone or Android phone almost always has an accessibility feature that allows you to use the magnifier. And I was kind of surprised by this. I knew, because I work in cell phones every day, but I was surprised at some of the stuff that she showed that you could do with it that I didn't know. So it looks like there's two different features in an iPhone, for example. One is the magnifier, and the other one is the accessibility that allows you to zoom. Both of them use the camera, and it's surprising how good the results can be. I'm going to let you in on a secret. I think I probably talked about this somewhere along the way, but I use an application called Camera Plus. You could find it in the App Store. There's both the paid version and a light version. The light version is free, and it has a macro mode where it shows the universal symbol for macro, which is a flower. When you tap on that, there's a slider that allows you to go from 1x to 3x magnification. I used that last summer on a number of occasions, just went out and played with it for a couple weeks, and I got some incredible photographs with my cell phone. And I can only imagine the iPhone X has an even better camera, and I've seen the new Galaxy cameras. Cell phone cameras are just amazing anymore. So this is a really, thoughtful way to get somebody into the idea of doing microscope stuff. And even if you're looking at a hive, there's two very strong recommendations. The first one is just look at the bottom board. Pull out your tray and look at what you'll find there. I remember doing this at EAS, and I probably have talked about it. It's amazing. This sounds a little morbid, but wings, legs, Varroa mite, wax scale, like little chunks of wax on the bottom board. There's all kinds of things to see there, and you just need your phone to do it. Or, quite frankly, you could use a magnifying glass. They had different magnifying devices there. An inexpensive scope. I think it was made by Intel. And I know that we had one that I've talked about for sure in the past that came with an Xbox or PlayStation that had this really kid's toy, but we got great magnification of a honeybee stinger and great photos from that. So you can buy an inexpensive kid's toy microscope and get quite a good result out of that. And she had two or three of them there, and I had brought my 27-inch monitors. I have dual monitors on my desk here and another monitor. That's a Tim Allen moment. this is a smidge of a Kevin moment. There is just not enough time in the day for having a small monitor. And if I could have 50-inch monitors, I would do it. In fact, I've been thinking about restructuring my desk. And when I do, I'm going even bigger. I might have one of those, like, six-panel monitor setups. Yeah. Anyway, back on task. We hooked those things up to the 27-inch monitors that I brought that night, and they look great. There was a picture of a Varroa that we pulled off the bottom board that they brought and put it in. It was like a 27-inch magnification of a Varroa mite. That's really cool. They had intermediate ones that you would find in schools or colleges, and then they brought the Mac Daddy ones that you would find in a university or really expensive research center. And Bill, who is Lorette's husband, he's a geek about this stuff. You could tell he's just a technology nerd from way, way back. In fact, I think from his bio, he was in Bell Labs and, he's done stuff we whippersnappers only dream about, based on what I saw from his website and his bio. He had this full sensor camera with a lens that had a tube attachment that you pull the eyepiece out of the microscope and you stick this thing in. And when you put a slide underneath, you could take photographs like a college textbook. It was the coolest setup. I took a photograph of it. Maybe somewhere along the line, I'll try and find time to post these out to the Facebook page or even my homepage. But then he had made posters of different pollen samples that he was taking. And he's working on mycelinology or something. Some word which means the study of pollen origins in honey. So he told the story of this honey that they had that was just spectacular. Like, you get that one honey that you just lust over it. And he gave it a great name that makes me want to try it. It's called Butter Honey. And he's on a quest to take the pollen samples out of that honey and figure out which plant they're working on. And who knows, he might have the next Manuka for all that's worth. And, you know, we talk about microscopes and pollen. Heart of hearts, these folks are, they run a nursery and they're, Lorette goes, what I met Lorette first on was that she's at bee meetings selling plants specifically good for bees. She talks about Peter Lintner, who wrote a book on different things, and she recommended that during the course of the talk. One of her favorite authors about plants. But Lorette is no slouch, and I'm sure Bill isn't either, about all the plants and stuff that they have in their nursery. They're one of those folks that gives you the Latin names and all the information. And I always am envious, as you've heard me say in the past, about folks who grasp this stuff. So Bill was making stains of the different pollens to try and identify them. And stains are, you know, if you look at a pollen. Wait, let me make something very clear. When we see pollen coming in on a bee, it's red, it's yellow, you could tell the origin. But when the pollen is mixed within honey and you're trying to figure out the source of the honey, you're not getting the colors when you are doing whatever it takes to put it on a slide and then put the cover on it and so on. So a lot of times what Bill described is he's using stains to, one, make them look better, and two, give them more defining characteristic. Not enough time to talk about how stains work, other than he said, when he first did it, you would put a minuscule amount and look at it, and it would just blow everything out. So when you use stains, you have to be exceedingly spare about the amount that you use. A little bit goes a long, long way. During the course of the talk, as they ran through the slides, one of the things Lorette spoke about was tools. If you're working with pollen granules or you're dissecting bees and doing all of that, she had a little pack, and she talked about, and forgive me, I just don't remember the detail on this. One of the things I was doing beyond making sure the microphones work and taking photos and all that, I just missed some of the details of it. But what I do recall her discussing was that you could buy different tools for different purposes. And something makes me think that she bought a jeweler's tool set because the tools had a finer points and so on, where if you bought a dentist one, for example, you may not be able to get the dexterity that you need. I think I have that right. It was a jeweler's set. How's that for coming to me at the last moment? So I thought that was really cool. And one of the highlights, again, was the bottom board exploration. They had a bottom board with pollen and with bees and varroa mite. And I think just about everybody, there were 50-plus people at this meeting, brought their phone and spent a lot of time getting very interested in looking at that. It was very approachable. So that might be something if you're associated with a beekeeping association and you want to have a meeting. That's stupid simple to do. Somebody bring a bottom board. You have a segment on it. You talk about what we did as far as the cell phones. And then you just let them have at it at a station. And they'll have a blast with that. It was a long anticipated session. But it was well worth staying the course and rescheduling it. The original one. We had the meeting scheduled and it got postponed because the venue lost heat. And we ended up having it at a high school, which wasn't the ideal venue, but it worked out in the end. So that's really, really neat. Okay, moving on. I know I'm running late here. Roundtable number 3 wanted to talk about BT in Lawrenceville. I've interviewed David Waldman on this program, and David lives in Hopewell, and there was a discussion that went out. He was sent a notice by his municipality, and apparently in Mercer County, they want to get ahead of the mosquito problem. This has been a topic on and off in beekeeping because some products that they choose tend to impact bees, and it's not good for beekeepers, and they have an acute interest in this. Last year, apparently, they did spray in Opal, and my understanding is that some folks were impacted. So David had taken the step of going to his local municipality and mentioning this, and this year they came back, and I just about crashed going to work the other day because I was driving up Nassau Park Boulevard, and I looked to the left, and I saw a helicopter, and I knew what it was doing, and I was trying to take my phone, don't do this, folks, and take a photo, and I almost ran into a Belgian block curb because the helicopter was spraying BT to try and kill mosquito larvae. So BT is the same product I've talked about on this program that you can spray on your combs. I'm sorry, it's not on label. Zentari is the name of the product that I spoke of that works with wax moth. This was a different variant. So Bob Kloss and I discussed this. BT has different species, and this one is meant for mosquitoes. And the helicopter was flying over, spraying this swamp area not too far from where I work. And there had been a huge amount of rain, so they were trying to spray this stuff. So, very interesting, but just wanted to relay that little tidbit of a story that communication was given to a municipality. They looked at it, they chose their option, and they switched to a more bee-friendly product. So you can make a difference by speaking up. So I think I'm going to shut the episode down here. I had something prepared for Malawi as another roundtable, but it sure seems like the episode's going to run long. I know people don't like to download large file sizes, and when it gets beyond 90 minutes, it gets a little unwieldy. So I wanted to close with a thought. It might be evident, it is to me when I listen in my RAV4, that I've been messing with the sound mixes for the show. Been experimenting with different equipment to clean up the sound, but just have not hit the right formula yet. Sometimes the mix has an awful hiss. I actually produced part of this show and listened to it on the way to work this morning, and the hiss is still there, and I've got to work through that. Sometimes the volume is too low, and it seems like in this episode I'm at it again. It starts with a few changes I made a couple months ago. As I've shared, I acquired a new, more capable software, and I've been trying to learn it. It's akin to trying to operate the controls of a, going from operating the controls of a simple Volkswagen bug. If you've ever driven one, they're very utilitarian. To flying a 747 jumbo jet, and the cockpit controls are just out of control. Very powerful, but sometimes bewildering. I finally got baselined on how to actually use the software and all its features, and it's made producing the show far easier and smoother. And I'm comfortable with it, but I have yet to get the sound right and to the way that I like it. The microphone that I switched to has been a little bit more of a struggle. The microphone requires a little bit more power to push the voice through the wire and into the computer and to be recorded. A lot of times when you compensate with this, you use something called gain, which is a sound term for turning up the volume. It takes whatever's coming into the microphone and it amplifies it. And it's great because it amplifies the voice and it's able to make it loud enough for you to hear. I don't sound like I'm standing on the other side of the room. But if there's a hiss or bad low tones, it amplifies those too. Last time I recorded, I did not amplify anything, and then the volume was so low that if you're in your car, you probably have it cranked all the way up. So it's not working. This week I borrowed the mixer from Northwest and put it in, and it has a phantom power which supplies more power, which prevents me from having to amplify the voice. And hey, maybe I sound better, I don't know. I know it especially sounds bad when you listen through earphones, so the whole reason I called this out is if you're suffering, I'm suffering too, and unfortunately I'm just a beekeeper who's trying to be a podcaster, and I am a little slow to get my mix together. So anyway, look, I'm working on it. Just tried to give you a heads up on that. And with that, let's go ahead and close out the episode. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back soon. Take care and be well.